Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Grace Watch Media. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan. And today, aside from being very congested and nasally, we have Josh Rubin on the podcast. It is his second time back on, and he is a very talented actor, writer, director that has a movie at Sundance, premiering at Sundance in January. It's his first movie. How annoying is that?
How great is that? Yeah, a lot has changed since we last had Josh on. He's still directing a ton of commercials, but his new film, Scare Me, is premiering at the Sundance Film Festival in January.
Yeah, it stars him and Aya Cash from You're the Worst.
Mm-hmm. And Rebecca Drysdale and Chris Redd.
From SNL.
Pretty cool cast, you guys. Very exciting. So what I love about this, because there's a handful of really great nuggets, but I think the thing that's really interesting that we talk about a decent amount is how Josh had a set of parameters that he gave himself when he first sat down to write this movie. And they were kind of, you know, some of them are more logistical, of like having a single location or things like that, limiting the number of characters, but also some of them are much more ideological. And so we dig in on what motivated him to make the film, why it was important to him, and why focusing on those things was kind of a breakthrough for him.
Right. And he's been directing for like, I don't know, 15 years or a very long time, but this is his first feature film, and it is a low budget feature film. And yeah, his story of how the idea came to him and how he got to Sundance is pretty awesome.
Pretty great.
I learned a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's another fun, special one. I feel like we've had a lot of like the indie fairy tale stories over this last year, and I love hearing them, and I love digging in on the actual nitty gritty of how those things came to be. So it's not just like, oh, everyone loves my scripts and I'm a genius and it all happened really easily. It's really about how Josh laid out 15 years worth of experience and connections and commitment to the craft and how that paid off in many surprising different ways.
Yeah, and I don't want to brag or anything, but like he said, one of the biggest influences in his life is this podcast. So mm-hmm.
Yeah, he said that he owes everything to Just Shoot It. So that's been pretty nice to hear.
He didn't really say that, but he does listen. And I do think that if Sundance filmmakers are listening to this podcast and you're listening to this podcast, then you are, by property of transition, also a Sundance filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Well, before we hop into our conversation with Josh, Oren, it has been a while. What have you been working on lately?
I've been pitching on some commercials. Didn't quite land anything this month, but I did work on a scripted podcast project with a friend of mine. And we wrote a TV show. We adapted it into a podcast, and then we cast actors and we recorded the whole thing and we're putting it together now. So it's like, it's kind of like a mini passion project.
I'm really looking forward to my kit fee on all the gear you used.
No, we didn't use any of your gear.
Oh, okay,
we only used my gear we recorded.
Okay, perfect.
But it was really fun. I wanted it to feel real, like an NPR type of docu-series or like S-Town or Serial or whatever, one of those. And so we didn't quite do it as much as I wanted. I mean, we recorded 30 pages in 2 days. So with all the actors. So first of all, I wanted all the actors together doing the scenes, which is something that, in voiceover and podcasts and stuff, a lot of times you don't do. You record each actor separately. But I had them all together, which was fun. And then we had a few driving scenes that we actually recorded driving.
Oh, while you're driving? That's fun.
And
that's
we had great. This like kind of thriller horror scene, like where this girl, she wakes up in the middle of the night and like she's hearing sounds outside of her window. Mm-hmm. And we kind of did that in my house. Like she starts on the couch,
oh,
she stands
up,
and she runs around, she wiggles the door.
That's so fun.
Yeah. We will have to add a lot of kind of sound design elements
and stuff. But even just like the way that it affects the way people breathe and their cadence and the performance and just the vocal quality will change. And so like you've got a foundation to layer on top of. It's kind of like VFX, right? Like if you do some things practically, then it makes the digital stuff more realistic.
Yeah. I'm curious to see how it all turns out. There's this one part where like her and her friend are driving in this car and someone yells at them from a different car. And I would just try to like have the actor that yelled at them like kind of go down the hallway in my house and yell from far away. But it feels like it's in a house. Like you can feel the hallway. You can. So
right.
There's some things I'm still kind of balancing that, but I'm going for like a realism here and we'll see how it turns out. But I'll let you know on the next catch up how it all cuts together.
Love it. That's so exciting.
Yeah. Oh, I also got, I'm talking about this at the end of the podcast, but I got a new light and I've been playing around with it a lot.
That's pretty fun too.
So yeah, all good stuff. But excited for 2020. Gonna have, I'm not going to look at any election news.
Oh my God.
For the next 11 months.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. Well, I am knee deep in both doing a final fundraising leg for my wife's feature, and then also we're in deep pre-production on it. So I actually,
Wait, you start shooting in like 18 days.
Yeah, I know.
High days is what Jewish people call it.
Yeah.
18 is high.
That's like a callback to a joke that we haven't gotten to yet in the recording.
Yeah, but also like anyone Jewish will know what I'm talking about, and anyone not Jewish will have no idea what I'm talking about.
I don't know what you're talking about, so there we go.
I want to make this episode re-listenable.
Re-listenable, perfect. Yeah, so we're really like rocking and rolling, filing permits, locking in casting and crew and all of the stuff.
Is the location your place?
The first location, the first of the two major locations is my place, yes.
Do you have the second location?
Not yet.
Do you have your neighbor's permission?
Yes.
And you have permits for your place?
Yes.
And you're shooting this like in a weird schedule, right?
Yeah, it's partially, the first leg is in like 3-day chunks basically, like over long weekends. And that's for a number of different logistical reasons, but it has been really helpful in kind of spacing things out and giving us a little bit of room to breathe on things. But yeah, it's the first 3 days start on the 17th.
And are you cast?
We are mostly cast, yes.
Cool.
I know.
And are you, like, is it hard to not be directing?
No. I've actually learned to have more fun producing. And it's challenging to be producing for your partner.
Are you the main producer?
It's myself, and then B. Chaheen is also producing. We've worked together for a really long time and has been kind of... She produced the short that my wife directed that I produced with her as well. So I knew her. We met on Squaresville. So like she's been a part of the team in a pretty significant way for a long time. So
and is your wife producing?
She is producing in the way that all like an micro budget indie directors have to produce. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's so crazy. You're going to be shooting a feature film.
I know.
Except your wife's feature film.
Yeah.
But it's your feature film.
Yeah, but... She wrote and directed
and is directing and acting is in it.
Acting as well. Yeah.
She's Josh Rubining this thing.
She is. Yeah. So it's been really exciting. And we'll talk, I'm sure, a lot more about it as it continues to go on. And apologies if I'm not on an episode or two here or there, guys.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait. I already made a list of co-hosts just in case this happened.
Great. Perfect.
Well, awesome. Well, before we get into Josh Rubin, the prototype for this type of filmmaking, we'd love to tell you about our Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/justshootitpod, you can find out more about it. It's a way that if you get something from the podcast, if you're one of those people that texts me and is like, hey, not a bad episode, then maybe you want to give us like $1 or $3 per month. If you give us $10, we'll send you a Just Shoot It hat. And you can be the coolest kid at your school.
So it's pretty cool.
That's it. Patreon.com/justshootitpod. And yeah, let's get on with the show.
I'm a commercial director, as you guys clearly know.
But you started out as an actor.
Absolutely. I wanted to act. So when I moved to New York City in 2001, literally 2 weeks after 9/11, to go to acting school, my buddy Sam Reich, who I met in summer camp with Elaine Carroll, my other buddy, we all met at the same time, summer camp, all moved to the city more or less at staggered points.
The city is New York.
02 in New York City. My parents had given me a camcorder for, I think, high school graduation that I'd had for quite a bit. Sam and I started making ridiculous little videos. Sam sort of said, there's this thing called the internet. This was pre-Flash, pre-YouTube. Mm-hmm. Let's put videos on the internet. Long story longer, we started a sketch group called Dutch West. We made 50 videos. Like, they started as QuickTime videos. Then when Flash was a thing, we started putting them on YouTube. Like, our first videos were like 10 minutes long. College Humor took a liking
to us.
Which
is long, you're saying.
Oh, which is long at the time.
I think it's coming back.
Yeah, long videos are back now.
Long videos are back. Now yeah. You can watch The Irishman only on...
yeah, YouTube
Irishman.tv.
They changed it back.
They did. And so basically, College Humor took a liking to us and was like, you do for us what you've been doing for yourselves. I worked at College Humor for 7 years. That was my film school. Made sketches about boobs and beer and video games. I left to start a production company, but I left to work with my partner at the time, Vince Payone. We directed a bunch of commercials.
Can I ask you, when you were at College Humor, I mean, I know you were in a bunch of sketches and you wrote a bunch of sketches, yeah. But were you like choosing camera angles and doing directory type stuff?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. And it was interesting because it took me, of the 7 years I was there, because I didn't go to film school and I just made sketches that were pretty basic. Three people talking around a table, but weird things happen when you cut back to Orin. He's wearing a bigger beard or whatever. Those kinds of level. That's real. It'll be bigger when I look back at you. Sure. It just was very visceral. And when I was on staff at College Humor, it became my anxiety heightened. And I sort of was like, you have a real crew now. It's not just handing the camera off to Matt and Orin.
Right.
It's... Yeah. You now have a crew of five who don't work at College Humor, the sound person, the et cetera, PAs. Now you got to make it good,
even though
they were pretty bad.
Yeah.
So my picking angles was, I mean, I would storyboard usually with Vin, who was shooting all of them at the time, and every line would be a shot. So like, okay, so there's a shot where they say that line, that's a shot, and then we go to Elaine, and she says this line, and that's a separate shot. And so my storyboards, quote unquote, would be like 15 pages. Mm-hmm. So I didn't, I honestly, because I didn't go to film school, I never thought of it filmically, technically. A close-up, I never understood that as coverage. I never understood that close-up could become a wide, could become a two-shot to an insert. So 6 years into my 7-year tenure at College Humor, I was like, oh, yeah, I can make it better. And as my commercial career took off, I became a little more, you know, technically proficient, I guess you could say. And the longest version of your guys' question of kind of how we got to Scare Me, my first feature, was as a commercial director – I was kind of at the end of my rope, and as an actor, constantly doing other people's stuff and also seeing buddies like Dean Peterson, who's made like 15 micro budget movies. I was like, I have to do this for me. I know there's a weird one in here. So it was a combination of my manager, Brian Steinberg, saying, you got to make something. We can find money for you. You know, the mythical.
The dentist money, I always say.
Right, yeah, right, sure, exactly. Sure. Or the myth of the $50,000 film, which is now the $400,000 film.
Sure.
If you want it to be seen, we can find a little bit of money for you with the people that we know. So between him saying, you're going to do it, it will happen.
Wait, sorry, just to stop you for a second. When you say the myth of the $400,000 film, are you saying that it's a myth?
The myth of the, so what
like,
I've
that's
learned.
Something dream, that, the that, goal. That's a dream, like something you wish you could have, or no. It's something that you... The myth is that you make a $400,000 film and you break into the business.
The myth of the $50,000 film, which is that seems to be the magic mystery team indie film, you know, the Dean Peterson movie where you're going to get that thing seen. Exactly. 50
By the way,
grand today.
It'll if you ever write a business proposal, I highly recommend you put Blair Witch Project as a movie comparable in there.
Paranormal Activity, 11,000.
Sure.
The myth is that for, you know, I can get 50 grand together and go shoot something, and then that will encompass my deliverables costs, my festival costs, my editing costs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The reality is, as my producer on Scare Me, Alex Bach, said, if you can make a movie for 50 grand, it's a matter of whether or not you want people, whether you want people to see it is a whole other thing, as right. I've learned, which is why a lot of people shoot a movie, quote unquote, for 50 grand or even 11 grand, and then look for 75 to get the thing, quote unquote, seen.
But I guess part of that myth is that you send your QuickTime file to Sundance and you get in, and then you say, like, hey, I'm premiering at Sundance. Who's going to buy this and pay for the deliverable?
I honestly guess so. My process going into what my movie was going to be with no thought whatsoever as to what those expenses would look like and what I would owe, beyond honestly taking 25 grand out of the 401k that had accumulated.
Wait, can you do that?
Not without a penalty, and I'm still waiting for it.
Yeah, yeah. You pay taxes, basically.
Absolutely. I'm happy to talk about that.
Is that the only penalty?
You get a significant penalty. My dad recently told me, he was like, you could have just taken a loan and you'll get less of a penalty.
You can take up to $10,000 for like a first time, for a hardship or a first time home buyer.
Yes.
Or
exactly.
School, I think you can pay for, right? University.
It's, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. There's a few loopholes and then you're just paying basic taxes.
But a hardship
on that
is
income.
Like, what? I want to make my movie.
Yeah. And when I Chucky dolled, that disbursement, I was like, I just don't care. And I knew that I wanted to, Joe Swanberg to a degree, partly own my movie. It was going to be all me.
The total budget of Scare Me $25,000?
Oh, no. Okay. I think we ended up shooting it for just short of $100,000.
Yeah, gotcha.
That's not what it ultimately cost to get kind of where we are. It also didn't cost $400,000, but I'm just saying it always ended up, as in my experience, right. Or did.
You're saying basically the cost of shooting a film is one thing, and then the cost of marketing that movie, delivering it to distributors, etc., is an additional $350,000, basically.
Well, that's the biggest swing ever. But it's a significant cost. You know, it can be the cost of the film to get through. I mean, I'm not an editor. You guys, I think, both edit. You could probably easily, you know, and Dean, for example, if Paul Briganti, guys like that.
Wait, but isn't the idea, like, if you are making the $50,000 movie or the $100,000 movie, that you shoot it, right? Then you bring it in Adobe Premiere, even if you're not an editor, and you start putting it together. And when you're on set, you're like, oh, there was magic. This is so cool. This is going to be so good. And then you start putting it together, and you're like, oh, wait, this movie really is good. Now, like, let's show it to some people, get some interest in it, then raise the rest of the money. It's like,
yeah.
Like, you don't have to know. Like, you don't have to have that $400,000 in the bank before you go start shooting the movie.
No, because
the Portuguese subtitles taken care of.
Right, before, because you don't know how far the movie's going to go before you make it, right?
The crazy thing is, my drop in the bucket, $25K, was a drop in the bucket. Because we had to prep for, I think we had four weeks of prep. This is like a tier zero. I'm learning everything. I don't even know what tier zero means. This was like a very, very, very low budget movie.
DGA, though.
DGA, yes. I even called the DGA and said, hey, if I wanted to shoot a zero budget film in my parents' backyard and I'm DGA, what do I have to do? And they basically told me, if you could shoot it for $2, but if you pay into your pension, you're good. The tricky thing is that not only do you have to hire a first AD, you have to that person has to hire a second AD, and or you also need a DGA UPM.
And they have like a certain amount of prep that's guaranteed as well. All
and you can't be your own UPM.
I can't, no, but there are addendums that you can make. I do not listen to me verbatim whatsoever, but We did have addendums or qualify for those. What are they? Not addendums. They're exceptions for sake of how low tier my first film was and everything like that. Like the first AD that I went to basically had to work on it remotely because she's like, well, for the cost, I can do it as an exception, but I have two kids. I'm not going to go up and work in the snow for, you know, 6 pennies a day or whatever the hell it is. but I can help you, guide you, X, Y, Z, and we can do it all above board. I'm jumping all over the place, but
the point, it's yeah. complicated, basically. Like, as a member of the DGA, there are things that are different than if you were just like, hey, I'm going to pick up a camera and go shoot it in my backyard.
And, but I will say that they, you know, they were super accommodating, and they, you know, they helped out. I think, honestly, SAG was a little more difficult. We didn't know, I think, until maybe a week or two out that we could qualify, like, that we were SAG qualified, and they, I think at one point they threatened the like newsletter thing. They do this new thing now where they're like, don't work with Josh Rubin because he, it's, sure, it's
yeah.
like,
oh, yeah, I've heard that before.
Yeah, yeah. It's like written by my, my high school, my favorite high school tattletale, Polly Sagley. Don't work with, or else, oh no, don't go to the backyard. His mom will order pizza.
Do you know there's like a Twitter feed or an Instagram account for SAG actors to like tattle on like FICOR actors.
Oh, interesting. I bet.
That's crazy. Yeah. What, you know, are FICOR, for those that don't know, are they're actors that were in SAG but basically like relinquished their SAG rights in order to work on non-union commercials.
Uh-huh.
Or non-union
projects. It's a scary ass, weird, tricky time. Like I luckily, there are, with these exceptions and with the state of the industry that we're in now, it at least, there's an understanding. People understand that you need to go out and just shoot it. That's right. A part of how you build up your career in order to,
you got
to
show people stuff.
You got to show people beyond stuff the script. In order to build momentum. Exactly.
But let me ask you, so obviously, you know, you have, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years of experience of making amazing work. Aside from like your taste and your experience as a filmmaker, like for people that are listening that are like, oh, I can get 25 grand or I can raise 100 grand to go make a movie. Since you had all this directing experience, like on bigger commercials and things,
mm-hmm.
were you getting hooked up with crew, with equipment, with other things? Like, did you have other things inherent in just being you, this experienced director, that made it easier for you to make this movie? Like
the biggest thing was Aya Cash, because
wait, Cash or Cast?
Aya Cash.
Oh, Aya Cash. I thought you said I had Cash.
Aya's Cast, which is me.
Yeah. You're the worst. And,
right. Aya Cash, the actress, the lead.
Soon to be Amazon's The Boys season 2.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
She's also great in
Easy.
Yes, she is great in Easy. Fosse Verdon.
Oh,
I was like, oh.
Yeah, yeah. She's Neil Simon's wife.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I should know her name and cut. I have known Aya's husband, Josh, for many years. We had the same voiceover agent in New York. And I'd met Aya a few times. She's always been super lovely and cool. And I don't know what on earth possessed me to think that she would even read something that I wrote. But I think I just sort of reached out and said, if I got this thing together, would you be interested in reading it? And she more or less was like,
and it's the lead part.
It's the lead. Yeah. It's essentially a two hander. And that three hander ends up being with Chris Redd from SNL,
who
absolutely blew our dicks off. He was so amazing. and the fourth is Rebecca Drysdale, who also totally blew our dicks off.
Sure.
Time's Wait, up.
Speaking but of that,
that's a cast, though, man. That is a cast.
It is a cast. It's so cool.
You have any? Is there a romantic connection between you and Aya's character in the movie?
Well, you'll just have to see. No, I can give that one away. I wanted to make something not only that had the sort of financial boundaries of. Here's what I told myself. I said I want to do something in one location. I want to write to my weird talents, everything from I can squat down like a troll and do voices to like make soundscapes.
It's mostly just the troll thing.
By the way, a quick aside before I forget, because I will for sure, is like there's like some video of you somewhere of you just doing like 8,000 impressions in one video.
It's probably like 12. It's but it
no,
feels
no, it's like way more.
It's like
the guy behind you in line at Starbucks.
Instagram impressions, basically.
They're like Vine length impressions.
I do little mini ones, but they're one offs. I've never done.
I don't even know if you compiled. Someone compiled.
Oh, maybe someone did. Yeah.
And put it, and it's so good.
Oh, thank you.
And so I guess if I were you, I would watch that one, trying to figure out what I'm good at.
Well,
everyone listening at home, if anyone on the internet has made a fan video of you,
please send it. Honestly, it was probably me to try to like get like editing it for JFL or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
anyway, my boundaries were, again, or my limitations I sort of set for myself, or the bullet points rather, was I'm going to write this to my strengths. I want to cast an actress that never will take her clothes off, that will not exploit herself sexually or romantically, and will do something she's never done before. Honestly, a challenging work. She'll make herself ugly. She'll do slapstick. She'll do shit she's never done. It'll be multidimensional. And also at the same time, I was experiencing the Me Too sort of situation through friends of mine, conversations I was having online. The Aziz thing happened. Louis C.K., Dan Harmon, Kevin Spacey, all of these kind of like heroes and pseudo heroes, and then female buddies of mine. I'm friends with a lot of feminist spokeswomen, just incredible women that I admire who were outspoken about their trauma and their experience. And I just sort of said, I want to go after the fuckheads that I knew, because some of the fuckheads that had put them in these sort of situations, these terrible situations, these are also the guys that I think bullied me in high school, or I think ignore me when I'm trying to order a drink, or also talk over me and us when we're trying to make a point, or don't listen and just sort of go out of their way to push buttons and such. So I kind of wanted to, without necessarily playing someone who I couldn't empathize with, I did want to go after that kind of toxic male without being preachy, and touch on the idea of a white guy, a male, being emasculated and feeling diminished in the face of a woman's talent. And that is something that I not only can identify sort of microcosmically, and also just as like as a man who's used to the privilege that I'm used to, but in the little tings when the female friends of mine might be getting a little more ahead or doing a little bit better, et cetera, and so like that morbid feeling as a writer and a filmmaker, like, wow, look at that little fire in my belly that's going, oh man, if only I could be, or how could she, or why is she? So let's exploit that. So that's a piece of why this whole thing happened quicker than if I just went, I want to make a movie about a guy and an alien in a house.
Right.
It's saying something. You have to say something. It's kind of what I'm learning now. It's like, oh, if you don't say something, if it just becomes about a guy and an alien in a house, it's not.
Wait, what about if there's time travel in there?
I mean, honestly, if it's about, Me Too, they're all going to be Me Too time traveling movies, and it's going to be my brand. But I think that's just, again, part of why this whole thing went, is because I felt something.
Wait, so that was the kernel of the idea, like,
essentially, yeah. I wanted to make something that was rewatchable, that felt almost Spielbergian and weird, that played to my strengths, that elevated an actress, and that went after the dudes in this kind of.
You started with a character, though, which that you felt like you could embody.
I think I started with me sort of going, how do I do my troll and like 19 right. other quote unquote characters?
How does that work?
Yeah. Yeah.
So let me ask though, because I think that now
I really want to see this movie now.
You've been talking about this movie for a long time now, mm-hmm. right? And working on it for even longer. And so you really distilled down those bullet points very clearly, right? Mm. At what point do you feel like those four or five bullet points really crystallized for you, and how far into the process were you? You're staring at the blank page. You're like, what do I write? Was it like, okay, I'm going to start with these limitations and these ideas? Mm-hmm. Or were you working your way through it, and then you kind of look back and you go, oh, that's what I was aiming at the whole time?
I knew, that's a really good question. I knew sitting down, because I'd also not only had my manager gone, you're going to do this. He sort of like put the language out there. You got to do it. You can do it. You have all these connections and all these buddies who are down to help, you know, the crews and everything else.
Had you written a feature before?
Oh, yeah, several. Yeah, but more kind of in the $500,000 to $10 million, $20 million range, not in the kind of micro budget. And the micro budgets that I had written previous, the one or two and a half or one and a half that I had, were so bad, like dating, you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. The guy in the house there, with the
yeah.
Especially for a married
yeah.
man.
Yeah. Yeah.
What if it's about Tinder though?
Tinder time travel was hard to write because it didn't exist. But I think I'm trying to recall because it happened very, very quickly.
Oh, interesting.
I think part of it was on top of my manager and also reading Like Brothers, which is phenomenally inspiring, at least for a film nerd like me. If you haven't read it,
you're blowing your unpaid endorsement.
Is that your endorsement?
Yeah, it isn't my paid endorsement, but I will fully endorse. Like Brothers by Mark and Jay Duplass is so inspiring.
It's a book?
It's a book. How does nobody recommend it?
It was an unpaid endorsement for sure.
I'm sure somebody.
I've never heard of this book.
It
was like a year ago, maybe, right?
Yes, correct. The two of them go through, it was probably a year and a half ago, and I think I read it in 2 days and then started writing this movie.
Oh, wow. You know, I think that, especially early on, I think people think about how you have to have a fully formed idea before you hit that page, right? And I think that so everyone's process is different, right? Some people mm-hmm. are like, you know, these are the four goals I have, and mm-hmm. like I'm going to write a thing around that. And sometimes you just have to work through mm-hmm. a screenplay before you realize, oh, this is what I was aiming for the whole time.
Yeah.
But people say fully formed idea before you type, like, interior, you know, fade in, right?
I disagree, actually. I think that I had a pretty serious dry spell writing wise because I thought that I needed to be outlining more thoroughly, and I realized that like my process is much more
vomit draft.
Same. Just get it out there and then fix it. It's gonna be bad.
This is, by the way, what Mark and Jay talk about in their books. Every other chapter is autobiographical, and they were obviously they run a
totally
business.
Ripped that off from Grapes of Wrath, but yeah, go on.
Yeah, they completely did. And Steinbeck, the Steinbeck estate versus Duplass, I mean, California. They talk about, you know, Jay being frustrated that Mark is like the monkey at the typewriter fast. And Jay is like, I need every letter to be perfect and I can't keep up. And yet when he's done, it's beautiful. And Mark is just more prolific, and that kind of collision. But I think what I knew that I was angry about my female friends being sexually harassed. I knew that I wanted to do all these sort of voices and characters, and it basically came down to what's a quippy, fast, cut this thing off at 90 pages, well-paced, rewatchable too. Was it just a word that came back? And maybe
how do you make something rewatchable?
Well,
Easter eggs.
From being a commercial director and like having people go, can you make it viral? Like, how can we make it most viral, that ancient
word?
And
also having success doing that.
Yeah, and I think also it's just us, like our taste, right. like enjoying those kind of fun movies. We just get when we watch, I don't know, Arachnophobia. We can pop Arachnophobia on because of the pace and the aesthetic and the music and the humor. It just has like a feel to it and a vibe. And I think I wanted to kind of capture that Spielbergian.
So rewatchable, and that not like Watchmen where you're like, you should probably rewatch this because you missed a million things.
Digestible for sure.
It's not about density, basically.
Not at all. No. In fact, I think it ends up being kind of a movie with a message disguised as a commercial movie, but shot for, you know, under $200,000. Was kind of the idea. So anyway, what was crystallizing was, well, this language, this banter between the two is quite quippy. And how can I showcase her and what, you know, bringing out an actress's talents and an opportunity with an opportunity she hasn't had before. And then myself, story contest. So it's essentially they're trying to out-scare each other. So the movie ends up becoming about two people in competition. So it's like the catharsis and the frustration of the creative process, but ultimately it's about she's better than me. And so that ultimately becomes the scariest part of it.
Cool. Yeah, man.
That's pretty good. That's really good.
And now that I made it, I think I'm kind of done.
It's so funny because I feel like I've seen a trailer of it, but there probably one doesn't exist. I think I just read a thorough description of
Black
it
Christmas.
On the Sundance.
Yeah.
No, I think on the when the movies were announced, I was like looking through them. I was like, oh,
that's the worst thing about Sundance is that you're like excited about all these movies and none of them have anything that you can watch. Right, because it's like
sometimes they have like trailers. I don't understand how that works.
I think they're like self-cut, and oftentimes they will be taken down because it's like, oh, you know, the distributor wants to like make sure that it's fresh for whomever they're distributing it to.
Yeah.
You know, like these movies aren't going to roll out for, you know, a long while, right? Yeah. So, you know, they want to kind of control the releases and the message. And
oh, that yeah. Stuff. That's a yeah. whole new thing with, like, now a Sundance and the Shutter thing. It's like we're suddenly like, ooh, let's take down the picture, the, like, rap pictures that we took. And we've shared, like, DP and I excitedly, and also sure. Dan Powell, our producer, we all shared photos, like, right away. Like, look at what we just worked yeah. on. Yeah.
That's
and
why then, you make an indie film, so that you don't get in trouble for, like, sharing pictures.
I know, that shit
set.
Drives me crazy. But in retrospect, I do like the idea. As a film goer, I like intrigue. And I'm not Jordan Peele, but I like when he releases a new poster. I agonize over it and go, oh, that one image or whatever. Honest, I'm obviously an unknown filmmaker, but I like the idea and the feeling of the fan-made picture posters or the intrigue. This movie has one image, you know, whatever. There
yeah,
are a few, but
I mean,
yeah.
that's it's just, I think, to me, like a movie like yours, like I think of like The Farewell, or I think of kind of other movies that came up kind of unexpectedly, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. It's like, I want to see that movie because now I heard the director yeah. on a podcast that I listen yeah. to, you know, I like it's about impressions. Like I keep hearing about this movie. I see it on people's favorite movie list. It's not like I'm seeing trailers for it on TV
yeah.
or a poster that is like posted on,
I think,
Huffington Post.
Some of it comes out of like an old school PR mentality, honestly, because I always used to joke, like, no one has ever seen a photo on Instagram and been like, well, I guess I love Josh and we're friends, but now that I've seen this rap photo, I'm probably not going to see his movie. Like,
oh,
no one
yeah,
ever
no,
does
no,
that,
no.
right?
Yeah.
But I think, like, the era of being able to release exclusives and for people, you know, like, diehard fans being able to, like, figure out, like, oh, okay, well, I followed Aya Cash's, you know, Instagram account and figured out this and that. And all, like, all of that stuff. That's all the power that PR people have,
mm-hmm.
right? And mm-hmm. so even though it, this kind of ephemeral stuff that's out there doesn't really mean much to the people who are regularly consuming it, I think that there are a few bad eggs out there that are, in their enthusiasm, are accidentally spoiling things for people. And so I think PR has become very reactive to that. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's easier just to say, take it all down, and we're going to control everything because we know none of it's up.
Yeah. And honestly, it takes pressure off. And, you know, my circumstance, I'm thrilled that Irony Point came aboard Dan Powell and Alex Box Company. And they were like, what capacity do you want us to be involved? That's literally the question that they asked.
Let's talk about
this.
That a little bit, because yeah. I think that they're an interesting company. Dan Powell, I always...
Right, are these the distributors?
They're the production company. So
that
yeah.
That made your movie?
Yeah. That
they came on before you shot.
They came on before I shot. They were the... Dan Powell basically said very early on, the dude has an impeccable eye for talent. And
he was at Comedy Central for years.
Yeah.
And then did the Amy
He's
Schumer
a
show. He did
a, He's like a producer, a showrunner, yeah. a director. Yeah, he
was always one of the guys I looked up to, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, well, did he co-create Ugly Americans?
Yeah.
I think he did.
Yeah.
So he
based
left
off
Comedy
of,
Central.
Off
to make
of an internet short.
Yeah.
Or internet series.
Yeah.
That I can't remember the name of now. But it was a similar sort of style. But basically he was the kind of guy who was like, oh, build great relationships with talent.
Yeah.
Leave, leverage all of the pre-existing relationships you have into an awesome career, and then you get to do whatever you want. And so
yeah.
he's just like making TV show after TV show and now movies and
he,
all that.
And he is one of, we were talking about producers before we started rolling, and there are few producers that will have great taste, that will deliver on their word, that will, you know, that will not sell you a shit bill of goods. And he delivered
on
his words.
And that are available.
And that are available. And Dan, I mean, Dan told me, I think a year before I even started writing, he said, I want to produce your first movie. I had a script that was at Monkey Paw for all of 2 seconds before the executive who fell in love with a previous project had sort of gone away. And Dan was like,
Monkey Paw is Jordan Peele's
company. Is Jordan Peele's company, right? And Dan got wind of that and was like, I want to be a part of your first film, whether it's this or whether it's something else. So I went to him when I sort of conceived of Scare Me, knowing that it was going to be a small resource film, that he'd produced Bridie Elliott's film, Clara's Ghost, and put a bit of money into it as well. I said, I can do this thing. I just threw out a number, to be totally honest. I said, I'm pretty sure I have an $80,000 movie. And he goes, $80,000? How can you do that? And I was like, my buddy Brendan, my DP, who used to be my intern at College Humor, I've been doing short films with him for 2 years.
Did you guys do the Star Wars thing?
We did. He directed that. And he and I wrote that or conceived of it with Charlie McQuaid, who put that together, who wrote it. Brilliant writer friend of mine. And
so good.
Thank you.
I randomly saw it on Dig, or someone was like, check out this insanely good Star Wars fan film.
Yeah. We just, Brandon and I like to just make stuff and along
and
with our buddy.
And who pays for something like that?
Oh, we pool money together. So it's my buddy Sean Derman, Brendan and I. Brendan has the full camera package. He's a total tech dude, completely out of the realm of my understanding. But he goes, it started with him years ago. He goes, hey, write whatever and do whatever you want, and I want to shoot and direct something.
And what, he's got like a 5D Mark II?
I mean, we think we shot on his, it was one of these smaller, oh God, he'd kill me, Sony A7S. Is that a small camera?
Sure.
Yeah.
Little teeny
tiny
guy.
So we shot a cabin, which was a very small kind of thriller about me in a cabin going crazy. And he made it look beautiful. He shot it on the Sony A7S. I was like, okay, cool. I'll write it and star in it. You shoot it and edit it.
Bro, don't you need more lights?
He had ice lights. They're like little light panels, and they're fucking awesome. They look like little lightsabers. Well, they're panels and the lightsaber lights, as I call them. But anyway, we'd been working together making these kind of shorts when he wasn't shooting for the Dodo or for, you know, Group 9 branded videos. He was dying, just as I was dying at College Humor, to do a narrative thing. So we'd done a few narrative shorts, including the Star Wars thing, and I went, you got to shoot my first movie. And he goes, even if we can't get 50 grand on Kickstarter, which is where we talked about first getting the money, we're going to make this. Let's promise each other, even if it's 10,000 of our own money, and we both take turns holding the boom. And I said, promise. So we got into conversations with Kickstarter, with a buddy there who I think is no longer there because Kickstarter did something shitty and laid off a bunch of people. But anyway, we were like into that conversation, talking about rewards and talking about like that strategy and that campaign. And then Dan kind of swept in and said, I think we can find the money elsewhere, especially since
he said 80 grand.
Right, yeah, especially since I offered to take, you know, a fraction of that out of my 401k, and I'm still waiting for the penalty.
And when you budget a movie 80 grand and you're the director, do you take a fee? Do you get paid something?
Eventually I will. The only thing I've been paid is my SAG low budget.
Sure,
indie,
like
which is basically me
125 a day. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
So you made rent that month.
Yeah, exactly, for the 14 days of shooting.
Right.
It was more than I thought it would be, but I paid myself.
Yeah.
It was strange. Yeah, deferred everything else.
That's nice. Right.
Yeah.
So, real quick, just going back to the Dan finding money thing,
mm-hmm.
How involved were you with that? And can you say what the final numbers ultimately were, or the ballpark?
I know it's under two.
Gotcha.
We shot 200. It.
We're saying though, because under 2 million is still a small movie.
I don't know what the final number is. I know that it's at or below 200,000. It's a very 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 small movie.
And Aya, was she attached after you found the money or before?
She was attached pretty early. That was, I think, the first step was let's get a cast attachment. So if it's the two of you, and then also we were trying to find our Carlo and our Bettina, the Chris Redd's role and Becky Drysdale's role.
But Dan came on before cast.
Dan came on. Yeah. He was the first phone call I made. First email I wrote. Yeah.
So that's interesting though, because it's a producer with a track record. I think there's a lot of people who would be like, SAG ULB 125, whatever MFN,
mm-hmm.
No thanks.
90% of our listeners don't know what you just said.
SAG ultra low budget, which
Merced
is
forward notions.
Yeah, more perfect. Basically, no one's making any money is what I'm getting at. There's a bunch of jargon to say, hey, we all agree that no one's going to make
it's
any
an
money.
Investment. So Dan, who's a brilliant business person, goes, this would be no skin or very little skin off my back if I take a larger percentage of ownership of this film and go to some buddies and ask for a few grand here and a few grand there, and we put this thing together and we just do it. And we just put the dates on the calendar. I scouted houses on my own. I ended up finding the house we ended up shooting in on Instagram. It's like an Instagram Airbnb in my hometown in Woodstock, where I also knew I wanted to shoot.
There's not that many houses in Woodstock. You can drive by all of them.
Yeah.
It's a small town.
Yeah, it's a small town.
You had to frame out the naked mud people.
Naked mud people, I had to kick out. Gave everyone what's called a speedball. I never tried it. But it's killed many a comedian. But we did a lot of legwork,
Sure, in advance.
Descriptive of an $80,000
film. Right, you know? Right. Yeah, you're still in it to win it. Right?
Wait, mm-hmm. can I want to just dig into the casting a little bit more. Because I think a lot of our listeners, like $100,000 first film is like a sweet spot, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, most of them don't have your experience, but like, so you, I think like it's kind of, you find this actress that is, has a lot of accolades. People recognize her a lot. She has a lot of fans, but she's not like unattainable. You have kind of a personal relationship to her. And then you approach her with a script that has like a part that is like the most challenging part for an actor that you can, that you have could come up with. Do you say to her, like, here's the start dates, here's the end date? Do you show her a deck? Do you say, this is why it's going to be good? Or do you just say, like, hey, can I send you a script?
I think I did show her a deck, but I think, honestly, the first... I can't remember the order of events. I'm pretty sure simultaneously to my completing writing the script, I reached out to her and said, hey, if we did this thing, when would you be available? Or if we did this, I knew whatever, Dan could do it in January, or I wanted to do it. I think initially we wanted to shoot in October. And I finished writing it. I wrote it in like a week in April or something. And I was like, I want to shoot a movie in the fall. Then that movie, then it got pushed, and then it got pushed.
And were you rewriting and stuff at the time? Or
not really, no.
And why did it get pushed? How did it get pushed?
It got pushed because we were having trouble finding funds. We only had the amount that, like, Dan had matched me personally. We went up to, like, one or two other people personally. I was writing to, you know, old bosses and saying, hey, I'm not sure if you fuck around in the movie game. Yeah, exactly.
What's your dad up to?
Like different buddies with connections to say, not sure if you know and so, but I, you know, whatever. They just wrote an article about me in Vulture. Can you please give me? So it took a minute, and I was getting frustrated. But when I knew by the time, whatever, Christmas hit that January was, it was going to happen. And even then, we were working against the clock, like the SAG thing, the DGA thing, and everything. But yeah. When I came aboard, it made it more real. Then we went, okay, cool. Now we've got this like cameo role, this like three-day role. And we were like, was getting ridiculous suggestions for who that would be. And because I'm with ICM and Artists First, formerly Prince Potter Young, they suggested this brilliant newcomer to SNL, Chris Redd, who I'd only seen in a couple of sketches. And they said, I guarantee you, he had just won an Emmy.
Pop star too, man.
Exactly. Pop star he killed. He'd done Disjointed. You got to get him aboard. And we sat down at breakfast in Harlem, and he, before he was taking his coat off, it was so moving. He goes, I love your script, man. I love it so much. Holy shit. It's so great. And we were just in it. I was like, I'm thrilled you think so. I'd love to have you any way, anywhere you want it.
Killer.
Yeah. It was
That's
cool.
That's awesome.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And now we're going to some damps. Yeah. I just wanted eyes on it. The only goal was just to get it in the can. And now, you know, you get that phone call.
Yeah.
Wait, what point did you have like a pretty good feeling about the movie? Obviously, you write it and you're excited. And then you get good feedback on the script, obviously. Aya, Chris, Dan.
Yeah.
But at what point are you like, this could be something?
And also, candidly, like, we have good friends who have made movies with people of that caliber that are great.
Yeah, higher caliber. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, or
more
people who are
kinda,
yeah.
more A-list
famous.
Type
yeah,
of
yeah.
people.
Yeah.
Like, recognize.
That don't.
Everyone's great. I love all
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, I hear.
Oren's saying everyone's very talented, but like someone so whose star meter is
right,
lower.
Right, right,
right.
Which is a good thing.
Right, yeah. Number one being the best. Who didn't get into Sundance is what I'm getting at. You know what I mean?
I think, again, my writing angry helped me having something to say. And I have, write from experience. I have very little experience in this life. I love to sit home and watch movies. And, you know, I usually don't socialize. Yeah. It's so fucking fun. Yeah. So I honestly put that to work and also put my anger to work and what little personal experience I have of what this film is. And I think that it just spoke to people. And the fact that I have a producer who's a woman, Alex Bach, she saw something in this film and in this situation, identified with this character who ends up in this terrible situation or this precarious situation at the end of this film, where she goes, we have to get behind this. We have to get the money. We have to. I mean, she fought for this movie tooth and nail in such an incredible way. I owe her, I mean, you know, every, I mean, I owe Dan the moon, but like Alex was like, no, I've been in this position as a woman. I know what this is. And she was able to go to bat and say, you know, movie has to be seen.
She loved the ending, you're saying.
She loved the ending. And, you know, it's funny. I can say this. I had a conversation. This might just be a hollow to say because I'm obviously not going to give away the ending. But we went to Ray and his company to get some money. He said, I'm not going to get in on this movie with you. But he suggested why an alternative ending to what I'd written would be better. And I was very resistant to it and ultimately came around to changing the ending because I had this conversation. So he is in the very special thanks in this film. And ultimately, I think it ended up, I've gotten feedback on the ending. Oh, thank God you didn't go that route. So when you guys see it, we can talk about it again.
Do you feel like your original ending was a little more traditional, like a Kiva Goldsman style, like, give them what they want, but not the way they wanted it. He just kind of like,
yeah,
gave you, like, your ending now is not what people are expecting.
Yeah, there's the Sopranos ending, which is not, you know, no one will be frustrated, hopefully, that the lights, you know, shut out five pregnant seconds before the credits. But it's certainly more nuanced, and it's a lot more layered and ends up positively in the hands of who the film should end up in, you know? Yeah. So,
cause going back to like what Matt was saying earlier about like looking at the blank page and like, you know, a lot of people are like, don't start writing until you kind of have an idea of what the movie is. Yeah. And this other podcast that I really enjoy, Script Notes, they always say like, you don't need to know anything except for the ending. Just like know where you're going. And they have a lot of conversations about where you're going to, but I feel like there's this trend and you kind of touched on it in the last few years where a movie is going isn't quite as important, like where a movie ends isn't quite as important as the thing that it's about, you know, like the message. And like even Micah, a guest we just had a couple weeks ago that wrote A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and he was writing on Transparent, and he kind of said this thing that really resonated with me, that he said, I don't care about dialogue, I'm not picky about scene direction, I don't even care like that much about who the characters are, what the order of the story is, I just am trying to capture a feeling, like a big feeling in each scene. And like if he's like, because on Transparent, I guess they got rewritten like a million. He would said they would write 300 pages for a 30-minute episode.
They'd rewrite in the middle of a scene. They would have shot half of the coverage already and reblocked things.
Crazy.
But like just, if you're thinking traditionally, like something you wouldn't do because it would ruin the scene, basically. Yeah. They would do all the time.
Yeah.
I think they do. They did things very differently than tradition. I have a friend who shot a couple episodes, and he said he had to go to a drum circle before he could shoot his episode. But the thing that he learned that he passed on to us is that it's like about this feeling. Like, make the scene be about something is more important than like the detail, the very specific details, which maybe the very specific details are part of what it is. But to me, obviously, we haven't seen your movie, but it must be good because of who's made it and where it's premiering. And it's just so interesting to me that like the ending is something that like came about after you'd already like attached cast, after you'd already shown it to people, after you already got big producers, and then you change the ending to something else, which to me is kind of indicative of like, maybe you don't have to have the perfect ending when you start writing your movie.
No, I mean, you know, look at Jordan Peele, his test audience situation for what Get Out ended up being. You know, he made it.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, originally, I think Daniel's character went to jail. It just ends with him sitting in a fucking prison cell, and then the door closes or something. The main dude, he gets arrested. So you're supposed to go, you still go, oh no, the cops are here, which is the brilliant...
Right. Right.
You know, flip. But then there's this dark ending where he's sitting in prison. And everyone goes like, no, come on. Like let's get his mo-fucking TSA dude.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they went back in and they reshot, you know, that triumphant ending. And I'm
oh, wow. That is a totally different ending.
Yeah, absolutely. And he'd been working on that fucker for, God, 5 years or 4 years. And was sending it around to, you know, I know Phil Jackson, who's a brilliant writer of mine. He works on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Yeah. And he was saying, I read the early version of that. And there was always something to it. And he clearly was feeling it, that, you know, in that script and eliciting feeling. And he was writing from a place of, you know.
Well, you see the poster, you know, it's like the guy... two like African American guys, but one guy's like putting out a fist bump, and the other one like tries to shake his hand.
Yeah.
And that's like it's so good. The core of that movie, and you're like, it doesn't really matter how it starts or how it ends if you get to that.
Well, and I think, you know, you were saying before, Josh, you know, you wrote that first draft in a week, right? You were just like,
couldn't stop. Like when you know that feeling we all know. Yeah.
And that's the speedball talking now.
Yeah, fair enough. But I think what's important to me about that, because I think sometimes it's going to take you a week to write a script, sometimes it's going to take you longer, and that's right? But the point is like, just get out of your own way, right? So like, okay, maybe you don't know the ending yet, or maybe you write the wrong ending. And then you start making the movie,
Preach.
And it's still the wrong ending.
Absolutely.
That's okay. It's okay. Like, just continue to work on it. Continue to make it better. Be open to notes that you maybe don't want to hear.
Yeah.
And eventually it'll get there.
Yeah, that's the Joss Whedon school of thought. I think he wrote that brilliant article that was just that included advice similar to, don't quote me, get the barf draft out, get the blueprint out so that then you can rework it.
He also talks about dessert first. Which is a thing.
Oh, interesting.
He like writes whatever the most fun scene is. He writes that first, but also literally he will eat dessert while he's doing it.
Well, he's also very wealthy. I can't afford to do that.
Yeah,
he can't afford to have Sunday first.
Just like before, like just the act of literally sitting down at the word processor or whatever he writes on it. I was going to say typewriter. When he's sitting down to write, he literally gives himself a treat just for sitting there.
Right.
Not even like, well, I'll get that slice of cake if I hit page 20.
Yeah.
No.
I'm going to sit down and make this enjoyable and it's to its
means
fullest.
I earned cake.
Yeah. That's rad.
That's why I do most of my writing at the Korean spa.
Yeah.
I like to get a massage.
And that's why I'm 6,000 pounds.
Well, one other thing. So just, I guess, the other thing that is really interesting about your movie and the source of the idea is, I mean, this is about Me Too specifically, like, I mean, obviously, I have thoughts and emotions and things regarding that whole thing and everything that's happening in our industry. But I always feel like it seems like it's my turn to like sit on the sidelines and listen and not say what I think. Like, you know, you see the Matt Damon stuff that happened with Project Greenlight and his other thing, you know, just but it's interesting that you found an angle in. That's not
offensive,
I guess.
I'm so excited to, I'm a little nervous, but I'm excited to get up there and talk about not specific moments when I felt X, Y, and Z, but that, I call it that morbid curiosity in myself where I notice those little devilish whispers. And I went, and me sort of going, not only do I want to bring that out in this character, I want you to empathize with him and you to like him. For these two people to both be imperfect, but ultimately for this ending to, I wanted to capture a situation that most women find themselves in at the end of a night at a party or a bar or whatever, when they're alone with a dude and they don't know if he's going to punch or kiss or touch or, you know, or just kind of roughhouse.
Wait, and just to be clear, is Aya the character that is the woman that you're talking about, or are you the
character? Okay. Well, in your movie, the film. Yeah.
But and also as a clarification, that morbid curiosity you're talking about, you're saying basically that you have felt feelings that you're uncomfortable with, right? Is that what you're saying? I'm trying to be delicate, but basically, no, like things that you aren't maybe the most proud of, or you're saying like, oh, I'm jealous of this person, you know, those little twinges of like feelings that, like I said, you aren't proud of maybe, and exploiting in relation to the Me Too movement in general, like the tiny little moments where you don't like yourself because you relate to a person who maybe acts on terrible impulses.
Less so for
me
when it relates to partly it's less so as it relates to harassment and more so because I was raised by a lioness mom,
you know,
a sister, a very docile dad, and several like very, you know, strong aunts. So I learned from a young age to respect women, and I don't have a problem being sort of, you know, like in their company, in their like very talented towering company and presence. A lot of men do. And I, as a shorter, you know, hairy, awkward kid, Sure. Who smelled like pepper, you know, and always wears gym clothes.
Wait, why the pepper?
Oh, please, dude, for those of you who, if you know, you know. I just creating color. I saw in the dudes who bullied, who talked over, who I was always the quiet kind of observer, and I was also a creative in this life. So observing what I observed and having friends that were mostly women and what they sort of kind of being there alongside their experiences, I was also a creative person who've had, I've had multiple creative partners. I've written scripts with several different people. Some have been easy. Some have been incredibly difficult.
You're poly-creative is what you're saying.
Poly-creative, but also like I've been in, I know the competitive process and the toxic competitive collaborative process very, very well. So the personal side of it for me, not only in the twinge of those feelings about women in particular who have advanced in life, it also has to do with the that sickly feeling of being diminished and the kind of toxic lean towards like,
right.
Oh man, if only I could have been, you know,
sure.
in that position, how I would make it better, or I would, you know, all those kind of, you know, the devilish thoughts. But just as equal is the topic of creative diminishment is so interesting to me, especially with gender politics and gender dynamics. So combining that, I mean, I'm getting like giddy kind of talking about it because we don't talk about this specific thing enough. We're talking about Me Too. We're talking about the power dynamic. But when you flip it and in the face of a powerful, talented woman, most men become, you know, quite toxically diminished.
Like how when, do you when they feel diminished. Those feelings?
Absolutely, yeah.
Because you're so used to being at a point
in a privileged position, And it's fascinating to me.
It makes me squirmy as well, for sure.
It should be. And I'm so excited. I want to ask, you know, I have, I can't imagine they would yet listen, but friends like Liz Plank, who's a terrific author, just wrote For the Love of Men, you know, about how men are raised, to Phoebe Robinson, to Vera Papasova, who used to be the health and wellness editor at Vogue. I want to go to these guys and basically ask them to moderate if you know, Scare Me kind of does the ranks, because there's that gender politic conversation that I would love to forum, you know, if we, whatever, tour with it or, you know, kind of, you know, through the festival circuit. It's a conversation I'm so excited to have, or at least to just explore and sit there and squirm myself too.
Yeah.
You know?
That's
cool.
Yeah.
So fascinating.
I have two more questions about Scare Me.
Okay.
Maybe we should just hint at your upcoming project too.
Oh yeah. I'll answer what I can answer for sure.
But who edited the movie?
Patrick Lawrence. He's brilliant. I really wanted a woman editor, not to sound like Matt Damon, best person for the job, all right? Best person for the job. But I really wanted the female perspective, especially in the edit. We're dealing with sensitive stuff at certain moments, and I was like kind of hemming and hawing about, even though we're low budget, even though, you know, these great dudes are available, I really, really, really wanted a female editor. And it sat down with and had a great interview with one, and she had to dip out for, frankly, a better gig. So at some point I was like, okay, I got to get this thing done. And the feedback I'd gotten about Patrick, especially from some buds who are in the LGBTQ+ community, were like, Patrick has edited for me and he is stellar and empathetic and sensitive and fantastic. When I met him, I was like, oh yeah, I get it. He's also edited, I think I'm his sixth or seventh Sundance project. So he just is like the magic editor. Wow. But I mean, he was phenomenal.
And I mean, this is a dumb question because obviously the answer is yes, but how did he make the movie a Sundance movie? You know, like what element is, like, is it in the kind of subtlety nuances of like music and transitions and cuts, like kind of editing stuff? Is it big story things, rearranging the movie? Like how much of this movie becomes like this amazing festival movie in post?
Because so much is shaped in post. I mean, I'll just say his taste. So I can articulate only so much if I go to coffee with an editor like I did with Patrick and say, I love Killing of a Sacred Deer and how Yorgos Lanthimos holds on tableaus and on shots and on these kind of squirmy, awkward moments and that awkward, irregular feeling. I love that. And him just kind of taking that philosophy and not only applying that to certain shots where he knows I hate overcutting, I hate cuttiness, and I like shooting economically, which is what I can address, just sort of hint at about my next right, project.
Because you storyboard every cut.
Yeah, exactly. Because every line is a shot. But he, his taste, he knew philosophically Josh likes to kind of hold on this, that, and the other thing, but he also knows, having had several features in festivals before, if the cut comes in at 1 hour and 58 minutes, this he goes, my heart dropped when he said, this thing's going to have to get a half an hour cut out of it. And I said, well, that's impossible.
30 minutes.
When the first cut, because it came in just under 2 hours. I said, no, it's not. And he goes, no, it will. And then sure enough, like one 12-minute scene, we shot 17 pages in one day. It was mostly one side. Got cut down to like a minute and a half, 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's great.
And the story still works. The
story works beautifully. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, that's great. That was the my one scene that was like the trouble scene is now a minute and a half. And he and I sort of, you know, we didn't fight over it, but he was very passionate about the direction. I mean, he was absolutely genius.
I mean, it's almost always better, shorter. That's the brutal truth,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and it's just like writing. You can write furiously for 3 hours or edit furiously for 3 hours and think it's absolutely genius gold and then walk away. And a week later, you come back and go, this is all shit. Let's change it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So really, I can't remember who said, you know, that a movie really, like, you have to sit with it. It moves and it's a living thing and it changes and you have to sit with it. It really, really, really is. It changed every time I watch it down.
I have a question that's a relatively large step backwards, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Oren, you inspired me in the same way that, like, oh, what does editing a Sundance movie look like? What does shooting a micro-budget Sundance movie look like? How big's your team?
And
how quickly are you shooting? Oh, yeah.
And my other question is
how are you lighting
it? This, which might help shape your answer, which is like, why a single location?
Budget. Single location is budget, so you sort of say, we're going to minimize our company moves. Every move costs money. That's lunch for the crew in every way, loading in and loading out, loss of money, loss of time.
But do you not get scared of that, like, film school look? Like, it's two people against a white wall in an apartment.
Terrifying. But I will say, the location that we found, the location's a character within itself. And the more committed these characters get to the stories, the more committed they are to the stories that they're telling, they're essentially improvising stories, the more they sort of manifest.
And they're transforming these locations into other locations.
Not into other locations. This is a sound designer's movie. This is a composer's movie. So the more they come to life, there's shadow play, there's music, there's sound design. If you're talking about the vampire, there's briefly the glint in your eye, you hear footsteps upstairs and the howling wind and et cetera, et cetera. So it feels like a big horror movie, or like that's the goal, but it's just two people going, you know what I mean? Sure. And I'm writing to the fact that I can go, you know what I mean? So, which makes it probably a Sundance movie. It's like, ooh, it's so specific and nuanced and blah, 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 blah. So one location, a lot of it is budget. The other piece of it is because I was starring in it and I had a phone call with Jim Cummings, kind of terrified 2 weeks out. I said, how the fuck do you star in it? You're in every scene and you direct it. And he goes, you know, the script.
One shot per scene.
Right. Well, the way he did it was one shot per scene. That wasn't how I did. But I get why he did it.
Were you one camera? Single camera?
Single camera. And again, economically, I knew each scene I sort of broke down, like, with my dense ass brain, like a play. Okay, well, I'm mostly going to be here. When I get up, we'll be on Dana Dolly. I move over to the side of the wall, which we rarely see. When she's sitting right here, she's on the floor. And when I go up the stairs, we're just above her head. So I know that I'm not just going to be moving the camera back and forth. We were real specific about, we're going to make this play. We're going to shoot the shit out of it, but also not make it super duper film school cutty or what have you.
When you say shoot the shit out of it, you mean you're going to cover every scene?
Not that we're going to cover every scene with a bunch of coverage, but that the shots are going to be cool to look at. They're going to be nice and interesting and punchy for your brain. The same way I thought about wardrobe. If this house is wood paneled walls and she's wearing a brown sweatshirt, that doesn't work for my brain. Mm-hmm. But if she has something with a pattern and then changes her shirt halfway through the movie, it's almost like a costume change. Same thing with me and the wardrobe I have. A nice blue with a gray and a beige pant would look nice with the knowing that this place is mostly dark with blue moonlight, with orange light. Thinking about, as a moviegoer, those little nuanced things like, my brain is going to get tired of watching the same two people in yellow sweatshirts the whole movie or whatever. So that was a place that I went sort of go, how can I keep someone like mine's brain working and alive and not wanting to look away because it's so, God, I'm staring at two. How am I going to make two people for 90 minutes interesting? So it's like that also being a piece of it. How you do it in 14 days is your actress is only available for 9 of the 14. So I had to Tetris scenes constantly. There was one scene we kept coming back to because I shot it without her, and it's massive, the first story.
When you say you shot it without her, you mean you didn't shoot her coverage and shot everything else?
Correct. We plugged her in. So I acted the thing full out for her, and the way that I direct.
Wait, so you had like somebody read her lines?
Yeah,
camera?
My girlfriend. Yeah. Lauren Sick, who's a brilliant director, by the way. She just directed the new Respect trailer teaser. You should check it out. She was reading opposite me, and I was acting the shit out of it on my side in front of the whole crew. And it's that you were asking about what a Sundance micro budget crew looks like. It looks like 9 dudes. Mostly dudes looking back up at you, scratching their heads, or just sort of watching, like, as the director slash boss slash producer slash writer actor is throwing himself around a loft like a werewolf. And then stopping, going, do we get anything? Okay, give the role, Brandon. Okay, cool. Okay, Ren. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it probably was entertaining for them, and at least that's what my experience of it was of their experience when they watched me tech, because I basically acted out the whole thing without making it like the Josh show, but here's where we're going to do this, here's where we're going to do that.
And I think I might have interrupted you, but what did Jim Cummings say was the answer to acting?
Jim said, know right. The script inside and out, know all your lines, which I did not know. There was one or two days when I was totally flummoxed for whatever reason. I think we had to wrap early one day because of a blizzard. We loaded in late because a van slid into a ditch. So there were just like little production things I was getting preoccupied with where I wasn't as prepared as I wanted to be. But he said, know the thing inside and out. And one thing I'd like to do is record the whole thing as a podcast, like as an audio file, so that I hear the movie, which I did. And
just your part.
Yeah, I never listened to it, but I did.
Thanks,
do it.
Thanks, Jim.
Yeah.
Did you hear his episode of ours, of Just Shoot It?
Ooh, no, I'm going to listen, though. Oh, you must have done it right after.
One of the first, it was when he had Thunder Road, the short. At Sundance.
Oh, man.
I don't think the movie had been made yet.
No. Oh, damn. Yeah.
And he said that he was working at College Humor, and every day as he was driving to work, he would just recite that monologue. I mean, that movie is just him talking, right? Mm-hmm. He would just recite the monologue in his car and like change little things and work on it. And he said like everyone in the cars next to him must have thought he was crazy.
Yeah.
But he just like every single day he acted out like on the way to work, on the way back from work, this monologue. So by the time it came to shoot it, it was like, you know, knowing the lines, knowing his choices was not something he had to worry about on set.
Yeah. That's brilliant. That's part of the move. Because you also, by the time that we shot, everyone was like, you must have been so stressed out. I was staying at my mom and dad's house 8 minutes from set with the DP and the first AD. My mom insisted on making, like, even if we wrapped at 10:30 and we were home at 11 or 10:35 or whatever, there'd be food, and she'd want, of course, my parents are so excited and so supportive, they want to know everything, and I'd be exhausted.
Sure,
you'd
be like, Mom, stop asking me how
I go. And I would go to set every day, and Brendan knew every shot because we talked about this movie ad nauseum. We shot listed it a month and a half out. We changed it as we went. I'd act it out. He'd shoot shit on his iPhone. We'd go to the Miz. We'd rehearse with Aya. We'd rehearse with Chris. We'd read through it. Read through it the night before, just my girlfriend and Brendan and I, before we shot.
The whole movie.
I mean, it was like a really magical Duplassian indie experience, down to the, you know, the pipes being frozen in the crew house the first day, it being the, you know, so there's a toilet bowl full of shit, we had to pour Avion down the bowl to flush it, the script supervisor's helping me flush the toilet, there's no hot breakfast because it costs too much, there's just muffins and bagels and coffee. And
well, on that note,
gotta change,
because I shot once in New York in upstate New York.
Oh, boy.
And that's where I'm we going. Got, I think we got hooked up with some food, but like for our listeners that are shooting like in their hometown, that's not LA or New York City or Chicago. What was, did you have any hookups like in terms of feeding the crew?
Like,
did
I recommended
your mom come make dessert?
Well, honestly, a couple of days because I'd mentioned that it was going to be an extra $1,000 maybe a week to have hot eggs every day or something, which I ended up taking out of my paycheck, my non-existent paycheck. Because you got to have hot food, especially when you're shooting in. Again, our first day was the coldest day in 8 years when we shot.
Which is what, like below zero?
Oh, yeah. I think the first day was like 14 below or something crazy. And it was the process trailer shooting day, quote unquote, which is just like a tow truck pulling our car. And it was nightmarish to watch people who hadn't been able to take a hot shower that morning or the night before. Right, just right. Like rig
shit onto a piece of ice.
Yeah. What? Yeah. I believe me, the day I found out about Sundance, I called the large, especially the crew members who were out there getting bit, as they called it, which is, you know, grip for electrocuted, and freezing.
Not funny enough.
You know, like, yeah. I called and said, we got
only the
in.
Grips get electrocuted. The electricians.
Yeah, right, exactly. I know. I obviously should have said.
Let me ask how you deal with talent in a circumstance like that, right? Like, I think, you know, because it's one thing to get people to come out for cut rate and cool opportunities and all that stuff, but like it's another thing to be like, and also there's not a trailer or like a honey wagon or fancy crafty or even your glam team or organic fabrics for your wardrobe or, but you know what I mean, there's all those other things that kind of add up that make a movie really expensive that aren't just their day rate.
I mean, you're probably telling them that, like, hey, this is a low budget movie when you meet with Chris, when you meet with Aya, right?
Oh, but, yeah.
But they've also been on huge TV shows.
Oh, yeah.
For years at this point. I guess
and
Chris
also
is maybe,
tiny, tiny movies, sure, both of true. Them. Both yeah. of them. And Aya's thing was, hey, I'm local. She's got a place upstate.
Oh, okay.
So if I get to do a movie with my friend and I get to go home every night, I don't give a fuck about the money. If it's fun. Of course, she ended
That's
up like,
pretty
you know,
crucial, though, being able to go home.
Being able to go home is a big thing. Like, if she was staying, there was one night we had a blizzard and Chris and I had to sleep on couches in my living room, in my home living room. And luckily, we all are like, you know, besties.
Because there aren't hotels in Woodstock, right?
There aren't hotels. We had crew house. She was local. I was local. And Chris stayed at a local spot that he was like, this seems like a prison cell. Maybe I could just stay at your place. He just ended up like not liking it. And I think, you know, we had a big storm roll in and we just ended up being way happier to stay at.
And you have did you have a makeup people?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had, makeup? Funny enough, Erica Pierce, who was my last minute phone call to shoot a short film I did called Freddie Darrell New Year's Eve, maybe 3 years ago. She mostly does weddings and some film stuff at the time. And now she's like, she works on all this stuff upstate. She's doing the next film as well. And she was awesome. Everybody loved her. Thank God.
Because to me, that's like, I mean, it, especially with like female actors, like,
oh, yeah.
If you are just have a makeup artist, or even preferably a hair and makeup person, and the male actors too, but you're just showing them like, hey, I'm going to commit to some resources for you to look good, to feel good, mm-hmm. and to like have, and you have a person that's literally like welcoming them in the morning and telling them
touching
what to
their
do
face.
So that you don't have to say like, okay, come here. You can sit there. You can do this. It's literally a crew position to like welcome the actors.
It is. Yeah.
And make you less.
And give them routine as well. It's like, oh, we know what to do. Like,
yeah, you know when you sit with me, there's going to be, I always had my phone like playing like chill music, you know, like come in, listen to Fleet Foxes or some, you know, some Neil Young and get your face touched.
Yeah.
If I had like a 5-person crew, I'd try to make one of those people a makeup artist just to, especially if I'm working with kind of more experienced actors that are aware of that, you know,
the big position. Thing about a makeup artist too, that Erica has zero ego, is they just got to be laid back, because sometimes, and I'm not saying I did this, but sometimes your actor is going to go like, let me just do this myself, especially actresses,
sure,
and your makeup artist sometimes can have an ego about it, you know, or an attitude. You catch an eye roll, God forbid. Erica is so easy and so cool, and that's what's so great about her, that everybody loves her. And
she lets all the actors do their own makeup.
Yeah, she's just like, my God. So she brings a lawn chair. And it takes up a lot of space.
Well, I feel like we can't end the interview without talking about your next project, which we touched on in our Natalie Metzger interview a few episodes ago. She saw a test screening of Scare Me and then thought that you might be a good fit for another project at her production company, Vanishing Angle. And now you pitched on it and
yeah,
you got it. And it's a much bigger movie.
Yeah, I was so reluctant to pitch on a whatever $5 million movie with Ubisoft's name on it. Like I looked at it and said, a video game movie? Absolutely not. I want my next thing to just be a little bit of a level up from Scare Me. I was resistant to the idea of the bigger movie. And the fact that Natalie Metzger was attached, the fact that like Greener Grass's producer, Natalie, who had done Jocelyn and Don Luby's...
And she's also doing Jim Cummings' next movie.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. She just wrapped the beta test. The fact that Vanishing Angle was attached, I was like, okay, so we have a Sundance Darling production company with Ubisoft, and it's also smaller. You're not talking about a $30 million movie. Let me just see what it's about. I read the script. Holy shit, it's super funny. It's really good. There was an option for me if I were to come aboard to polish it and kind of make it more my own. So... the advice when I went in and pitched, I made a keynote presentation and
not unlike a commercial treatment.
Mm. I don't normally do my own. I write my own treatments, but I don't design them. So I just, in a terrified fashion, kind of figured out keynote. It was actually very easy and great. Highly recommended, and plugged my computer in and, you know, siphoned through these images. And
how many pages?
Oh God, I think I want to say like 58.
And a lot of like full page images. A
lot of full page images. And I'm going through this thing too in a conference room with three executives and one of the producers, Matt Miller from Vanishing Angle. So I'm terrified. So I'm just meeting these people for the first time.
But you'd rehearsed this presentation.
I'd read through it. I'm pretty good on my toes. I just knew if I could get in just like any pitch, if I could get in on a personal level, that then it kind of rolls from there. And the other thing was, I said, if this movie isn't good, I'm not just going to pitch on it for a paycheck or an accolade. I have to see it. So my advice to anyone pitching ever, and certainly what I did, is just pitch the movie that you want to make and be super adamant about it. And then if you don't get it, too bad. Sure, and right, whatever.
Yeah. Because don't pitch the movie you think they want,
because then you'll be locked into it and they'll say, well, you promised that they were going to have big smiley faces and funny sombreros. I got it because I saw it and I like it. It's a movie that I'd like to make. I can tell you it's basically a comedy ensemble whodunit. The fact that Knives Out just came out makes me very, very sure. Scared because it's the best one in recent.
The knives are back years. In. Don't worry.
Knives are back in. They're not out.
It's not Lee's Kill List, right?
That's it's not Lee's project. Kill List. That was that's long dead pilot presentation, and not damn a Ubisoft.
This IMDb Pro account I just paid for. It's
no,
worthless.
It's really cool. So I'm learning all kinds of shit about how slow casting can take, how reluctant actors are to come aboard when you're an unknown director, of the fact.
I'm interested in that because I feel like I've been attached to a few features that went nowhere because we just had trouble casting them. And to be honest, some of them I was not super passionate about. So I, you know, it was like,
totally understand.
Hey, write a letter to this actor. And we're going to send them the script.
And you're like, and I've loved you since
IMDb. Scroll, I loved you since scroll. House of Cards.
Yeah, yeah.
But I've thought, like, if I was really into this project, like, what would I do to get an actor? Because I know an actor doesn't know me. So why would they trust me to direct them and to make something? Like, do you send the actors Scare Me? Do you say, I mean, now you can say, like, the Sundance film. They don't even have to watch the movie.
They do, actually. I mean, there's still a fear if you're an actor and, you know, the title of the movie has may or may not have a creature's name in it. So it's like when you're hearing about
Warren just turned to his laptop.
When you're hearing about a genre movie and an unknown director, despite the fact that their first movie just got into Sundance, you still have to have a phone call. Those bigger actors are less likely to talk to you. Luckily, what's happening now is it's busy out there. There's Quibi, there's HBO Max, there's you name it. So what's happening is I'm able to go to, we're able to take what they call the big swings. Wouldn't it be crazy if we got whatever, Nicolas Cage to cameo in this thing? And then ultimately, I'm friends with terrific actors, some of which who aren't available, but at least I can write them directly and say, hey, would you be available to come do this thing? So that's been a really exciting thing for me to bring to, you know, a company like Ubisoft. Sure. And to say, hey, you know, I can, like, reach out to...
This is cool. Know. Yeah, these people could be right.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm
think,
cool.
Yeah, I gotcha. I think that especially with the indie version of casting, I think that so often it just comes down to personal relationships. It's just like, who do you know? Who can you
it
get
totally
to?
Is.
Who can vouch for you, basically?
My big anxiety about this movie isn't special effects. It isn't the fact that it's one of the bigger jobs I've ever done. I've worked on some big stuff, but it's an ensemble of 8 to 12 actors. Mm-hmm. So my whole thing is personalities. I'm having, our casting director is Gail Keller. She's unfucking real. She does What We Do in the Shadows and movies and TV shows. Great New York casting director.
But the casting director doesn't really cast your Nicolas Cages.
They're pretty integral, what I'm learning, you know. I mean, their connections are major. They vouch for you as a director. They vouch for the team. They can gut check, you know.
They also have leverage, like, oh, you don't want to mess with Gail. Like, she's great, you know.
Yeah,
like,
she's gonna
do another movie down
right.
the line.
Maybe
they
she'll
want you to
push
think of,
to have you yeah. in the right. next Taika Waititi show
right.
or whatever.
Right, exactly.
But Gail has to be like, Josh Rubin is incredible. I just saw his movie. You just
right.
got to meet him. His energy is infectious. She's got to, like, sell you.
She has to sell.
But they're listening to that first pitch from her because she
right.
is who she is.
Right, correct. If you have an email coming in from Gail Keller, you should
listen.
Yeah, you
yeah.
listen up.
Yeah.
So it's been fascinating to just, you know, we have a grid of actors and I get to go like, oh, let's try this big person whose movie I loved,
yeah.
you know, recently. Like, you yeah. know, Michael Shannon.
Sure.
And then you find out if Michael Shannon's and it says a veil next to Michael
Think
Shannon's
about
name.
Michael Shannon, Jamie Lee Curtis, Chris Evans.
Oh, my God. Don. Yeah. Don Johnson.
Yeah.
yeah.
Christopher Plummer. Boy, that is a good cast.
God, when we got, yeah, Lakeith.
yeah, yeah, right. So funny.
That's the cast of Knives Out.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah,
sorry.
Just
put
the
together.
Name of the movie.
This is like,
you got it.
A game show.
Yeah, we figured it out.
Start naming me cast members and I'll guess what
instead
movie
of ding, 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 it's shing, shing, shing. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
The sounds
sheath,
of knives.
Sheath removal.
Sheath.
Yeah, right.
That wave.
But yeah, well, man, I'm the only thing I'm nervous about is just wrangling 8 people, 8 personalities. So what I was going to say about Gail is my policy is no assholes. The biggest thing is that
with the actors,
with the actors. So it's like, ideally I'm pulling in buds, but if there's those some actors I don't know, or if we go to the bigger swing, my first question to Gail is, do you hear they're cool? Are they cool? Are they a good person? I don't like strong personalities in general. I don't take that the wrong way. I
yeah,
can't.
You
deal
want
with
to be the only one.
Big egos. Yeah. That's yeah. Sick. I just don't do it.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I think that's why we all pick our tribe,
sure.
you know, as we, like Natalie was talking about, you know, like the why we keep pairing up with the same actors
right.
when we work and direct yeah. stuff. So that's going to be that'll be the next adventure is like, okay, cool. Wrangling all my actor cats.
Well, that's Josh, cool. we are so excited for you.
An easy tip, like a quick tip, is that if you just tie all their shoelaces together, they have to work as one.
SAG Insurance just called and said, the 9 noses that just broke, that's going to cost you the budget.
Yeah.
Unpaid endorsements.
So, you know, we had Ted Sim on the podcast a while ago. He's also a filmmaker and has revitalized Film Riot. And he also owns a lighting company, Aperture Lighting, and he hooked me up, I mean, with a little bit of a discount on the Aperture 120D Mark II and the Light Dome 2. They're great. I just got them. But basically, I wanted to get like a really nice LED light to help to shoot. My wife puts herself on tape all the time, and I have these 2 crappy lights, and, you know, they just kind of always looks a little crappy, and they're not that diffused and everything, and so I was setting up my lighting setup, and this this light has this like giant chimera, like kind of light, like a 38-inch dome, right? And so I've been kind of, you know, I've started out shooting all my own stuff, and I'm pretty into cameras and lighting and stuff. And for some reason in my mind, like if you want a softer, like big soft light is always the best, right? You want, especially if you want to make someone look good, right? You make their skin look good. You want to make the wrinkles go away. You want like a big soft source. And I guess, I don't know why in my mind it was always like, let's get like as big of a diffusion as we can get, or like even double break a light, which means, you know, you put a piece of diffusion in front of it, and then like 5 feet in front of that, you put in a bigger piece of diffusion and put it far away, right? Because you don't want it to feel sourcey. You don't want to feel like the light is like, is theirs, because it's reflected in a person's skin and they look shiny. And to me, like, you're just trying to make people not look shiny, right? First and foremost. And so I showed my setup to my DP. I'm like, I don't know, this isn't like looking that great. It's like a really expensive light. Like I put it here far away from my wife. You know, it's on this giant, like, it's a triple broken. There's like three layers of diffusion. What's going on? And he's like, oh, you, with the big light like that, you need to put it as close as possible to the actor.
Oh.
And I was like, wait, but I kind of always think like the farther a light is away, the more it spreads, right? The angle. And he's like, well, you always want a bigger light, right? That's why bounces look good, because you're bouncing like, you know, a very small light against like a 8-foot by 4-foot piece of foam core or something that's a big light. And so to make lights bigger, you move them closer to the actor, right? Because the actor is pretty much like a mirror for your lights. And it's just kind of blew my mind, because I've been shooting stuff like that. I've done like a bazillion interviews and EPKs and just close-up shots of actors and everything. And to me, it's always like giant light as far away as possible. It also obviously gives you some room to move and stuff, which you don't really need in an audition.
But yeah, when you think about it, that house is like right there, right?
Yeah.
The bounce.
But then, yeah, that the closer a light is, or a big diffused light dome is to your actor, the bigger it is relative to their skin. So if it's far away, instead of just being like a tiny shine on their cheek, now it's like reflecting on their nose and their ear and everything. Yeah. And so I've just like totally changed my philosophy of lighting with those light domes, or a China ball or anything like that, which is...
Get up in there.
Giant big bounces are great, you know, especially if you're kind of bouncing off of something. But if you have one of those big chimeras, put it as like on the edge of frame every time, and like as close to your actor as possible to, if you're going for a pretty look, you know. If you have Clive Owen and it's Children of Men, you're probably not going for that. But, you know, for just kind of pretty lighting, bring those big lights close. So that's my unpaid endorsement. Sorry, it was a long way to get there.
I like that.
I like
it. I'm going to use that.
Yeah. Josh, what you got, buddy?
What don't you got?
What don't I got? Thank you so much, guys. Pouring to you live from this side of the table. Dave Paulett Art. Mm-hmm. Dave Paulett Art, Instagram.
How do you spell Paulett?
P-O-L-L-O-T. Dave Paulett Art, all one word. His name is Dave Paulett. He is a painter who does these, like, classic paintings, but then adds like a modern touch. Like, for example, he'll do, I'll show you guys this like impeccable like image of flowers, and then just toss in like M&Ms, like a bag of M&Ms or McDonald's. He does some horror movie characters, so he'll do like a beautiful picture of like a Victorian girl by the water, but then put like Michael Myers stalking her. Some stuff with like Beetlejuice. He has this beautiful one of Jack Torrance tearing through canvas. I've gotten some prints for buddies for birthdays and Christmas presents, nice. A couple Christmas presents, but I really, really like his art. He does this Beetlejuice one that I love of the a sandworm like curling up a lighthouse.
Like Monet meets Warhol.
And it's like Monet. Yeah, it's kind of like Warhol style. Love. I really, really do love. Ben, yeah, just kind of going down a big old surreal art wormhole. I don't know if you call that surreal, but yeah.
Yes. You know what I love about that also is the idea of wormhole. Like having like a go-to gift. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like I love like this art as something I really love. I think
I will, though, just put as an aside, like giving someone art as a gift is risky. Like today, my wife we were going through the basement together, and I have a lot of art.
There are no basements in California.
It is weird that you guys have a basement.
We live on the hill. It's
that's a line from Zodiac. Anyway.
Oh yeah, it
is. Is that Mark?
That's why I blacklisted that movie. But she made me throw away a lot of art. I'm like, this is like my friend painted it. This is like an awesome picture I got for a birthday gift. This is like, just like, it's been in the basement for 8 years. Sure. I'm like, yeah, but like, what if I shoot a scene and I need a piece of art? She's like, you can't use this thing from whatever, some random art store. I'm like, okay. So we just gave it all to Goodwill. So yeah, but that art is awesome. Send make a card out of it.
Yeah, make a card out of it.
And then reading cards.
Something smaller to throw away is better.
Put it in the basement.
You know, Marie Kondo says the value of a gift is in the exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you receive the gift has already like done its work for this universe. Mm-hmm. So you can get rid of it without any guilt. It
reminds me of the tweet video of a parent giving a daughter a banana wrapped in newspaper. And the daughter, the 3-year-old, like opens up and goes, banana! So happy.
That sounds good, actually.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, my endorsement is a short from Short of the Week, our old pals at Short of the Week. And it's by, do you guys know Terry Timely? Do you know that group?
No.
Terry Timely is like, I think they call themselves a video band. They're like a collective of filmmakers. It's like, I think 3 people. Kind of.
Oh, that's all you need for a collective now? 3 people?
You know.
Sound like my a family bunch of idiots to me.
This isn't my family party. It's my collective, okay?
Well, I think we've all probably lost jobs to these guys. They're real solid, but they've got a short called Lazy Susan, and it's about the... It's like a imagined...
The inventor?
Fictionalized version of the inventor of the
I've seen it.
Ooh, have you seen it?
Yeah, yeah.
You loved it, right?
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I've pulled images from it from a treatment.
Yeah. Are they totally. Like the Daniels?
Yeah, but they predate the Daniels. Yeah.
But they're a collective. There's 3 of them.
Oh, they're a collective. So it's like radio silence.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
They're radio silence.
Yeah, yeah.
They've been on the podcast.
That's right. I listened to that one too. That's crazy.
It's pretty good. Yeah.
That's you guys have some big people. That's my endorsement. Just shoot it. That's my endorsement.
We didn't realize how famous they were when they came in.
And so yeah.
People were like, were they, excited
and they were
about
like,
it.
Gotta be the coolest.
Yeah, dessert. Just like just nice like, mellow dudes who wanted to talk about Indiana Jones with us.
Yeah.
Like they would have stayed an hour or 2 longer.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're rad. They seem like just you know, one of us. Hey, yeah. Let's go shoot some VHS out in the on the desert. Yeah. By that I mean a horror anthology, you know what I'm saying?
Totally disproved their name by being on this podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, quite but, talkative dudes.
Oh gosh. Well, when you get 5 people in a room.
Yeah.
Well, cool. If we want to find out more about Scare Me, Josh Rubin, your Tinder,
the whole
account,
shebang. Yeah.
Check out my website joshsmindhouse.com.
Serious?
Yeah, can you believe it?
No apostrophe, though.
No apostrophe.
That was the name of your podcast.
That was the name of my podcast, and now it's just, you know what? It's just going to be my brand. It's also my S Corp. Josh's Mindhouse, Inc. Send a check to Toro 2209 Dorson. Yeah.
Oh. Let's hear your EIN, please, real quick, just so we can...
You have an S Corp service?
Yeah. I have an S Corp service. It's very unsexy, and time's up. Yeah, it's just Josh Rubin on Twitter, you know? What can I say? RUBEN, guys, not like the sandwich. Like Rubin Blades.
Well, thanks so much, Josh. You can learn about all of the things that we talked about on the show at justshootitpod.com.
And if you have any questions, email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com.
Social media at justshootitpod. I'm at Mr. Matt and Lowe.
I'm on Instagram at O Kaplan. This episode was edited by Sarah Weirda. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And we would love an iTunes review if you get some time to do that. And we will catch you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.